Well, I'm going to, thank you. And this is a very entertaining lectern. The whole purpose of my speech is to keep from rolling over there and landing on my head. So be excited, folks, and sort of in suspense. I'm going to read a short piece in favor of the 50-year farm bill, and then I'm going to get on to words of wisdom. The uplands of my home country in north central Kentucky are sloping and easily eroded, dependent for safekeeping upon year-round cover of perennial plants. Its best agricultural use is for the production of grazing animals. Most of the land in pastures and hay fields, and perhaps 5 to 10% plowed and row cropped in any year. This was the practice of the best farmers of that country 50 or 60 years ago. The land husbandry there, as elsewhere, has been in decline since the end of World War II, as agriculture has become more and more industrial, and more of the farming people have taken urban jobs or moved away. But recently, and almost suddenly, as ethanol production has driven up the price of grain, our fragile uplands have been invaded by corn and soybeans. Whole farms with sloping fields that have been in grass as long as I can remember have been herbicided and planted to annual crops that, because of the drastic reduction of the number of farmers, will not be protected in winter by fall-sown cover crops. This is agriculture determined entirely by the market and limited only by the capacities of machines and chemicals. Its entirely predictable ruination is the result of degenerate science and the collapse of local farming cultures. Industrial agriculture characteristically proceeds by single solutions to single problems. If you want the most money from your land this year, grow the crops for which the market price is highest. Though the ground is sloping, kill the standing vegetation and use a no-till planter. For weed control, plant an herbicide-resistant crop variety and use more herbicide. But even officially approved industrial technologies do not alter reality. The supposed soil saving of no-till farming applies to annual crops during the growing season, but the weather continues through the fall and winter and early spring. Rain continues, snow falls, the ground freezes and thaws. A dead sod or dead weeds or the dead residue of annual crops is not an adequate ground cover. If this usage continues year after year on sloping land, and especially following soybeans, the soil will erode. It will do so increasingly. And this will be erosion of ground already poisoned. Moreover, even with the use of no-till and minimum-till technologies, runoff carries half of the applied national nitrogen fertilizer into the Mississippi River and finally the dead zone of the Gulf of Mexico. Thus, an enormous economic loss to farmers becomes an enormous ecological loss as well. The industrial providers of single solutions assume that the agricultural structure of a country, a region, or a farm can be built piecemeal of disparate single parts, not necessarily or even probably fitting either the other parts or the farm or the local ecosystem, and yet ultimately resolving into a coherent, sensible, even a sustainable pattern by the disposition of the market. This obviously can make no sense. A good or a sustainable farm cannot be made in this way. Its parts, even its industrial parts, can be made coherent and lasting only in obedience to the natural laws that order and sustain the local forest or prairie ecosystem. This is not an option. It is a necessity. By ignoring it, we have condemned our land to continuous waste and pollution, and our cultures of husbandry to extinction. To hope to correct the consequent disorder, which is both human and natural, we have to begin by recognizing the fundamental incompatibility between industrial systems and natural systems, machines and creatures. This recognition is not new. The problem was closely studied and made clear by such reputable people as J. Russell Smith, Albert Howard, and Aldo Leopold, whose publications were available in the mid-20th century when the all-out industrialization of farming got underway. I have now described the need for a farm bill that makes sense of and for agriculture, not the fiscal and political sense of agriculture, as in the customary five-year farm bills, but the ecological sense, without which agricultural sense cannot be made, and without which agriculture cannot be made sustainable. A 50-year farm bill, which has been in circulation now for more than 3 years, is a proposal by the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, with the concurrence of numerous allied groups and individuals. This bill addresses the most urgent problems of our dominant way of agriculture: soil erosion, soil and water pollution by toxic chemicals, loss of biodiversity, the destruction of farming communities and cultures. It addresses these problems by invoking nature's primary law, in default of which her other laws are of no avail: keep the ground covered, and keep it covered by preference with perennial plants. At present, 80% of our farmable acreage is planted in annual crops, only 20% having the benefit or the beneficent coverage of perennials. This, by the standard of any healthy ecosystem, is absurdly disproportionate. Annual plants are nature's emergency medical service, seated in wounds and scars to hold the land until the perennial cover is reestablished. By this rule, our present agriculture, giving 80% of our farmland to annuals, is in a state of emergency. But you can't run a landscape any more than you can run your life indefinitely as a state of emergency. To live your life, to live in your place, you have got to bring about a settlement that does not involve you continuously in worry, loss, and grief. And so, a 50-year farm bill proposes a 50-year schedule by which the present ratio of 80% annual to 20% perennial would be exactly reversed. The ratio then would be 20% annual to 80% perennial. And perhaps I need to say plainly here that the perennial crops would be forages and grains. Nobody at present is talking about perennial table vegetables. By the proposed reversal of the ratio of perennials to annuals, reducing annual plowing by 4/5, and making it possible to plow in any year only the least vulnerable land, soil erosion would be radically reduced. Chemical pollution also would be substantially reduced because perennials grown in polyculture, as already in most pastures and many hay fields, are more self-sustaining and less chemical dependent than annual monocultures. This proposed great change would involve many smaller changes, all of which cannot be foreseen, let alone discussed in a short speech. I would like to enlarge upon just one of its implications. The perennial plant cover we're talking about would be of several kinds: permanent pastures, pastures in rotation with row crops, perennial crops grown for hay or silage, and starting perhaps within 10 years, perennial grain crops grown in polycultures, which at times can and probably should be used for grazing. And so one of the most important results of the re-perennialization of agriculture would be the movement of farm animals out of the wretched confinement factories where they don't and can never belong, and back onto the pastures and into the open air where they do belong. Besides an immense kindness, this movement would be a return to ecological health. It would transfer vast tonnages of so-called animal waste from the watercourses, where it is a pollutant, to our actual food-producing acreage, where it is an indispensable fertilizer. This, I hope, will also start us thinking again about the disposal of so-called human waste. One of our great needs now is for human eaters to understand their eating as just one event within the fertility cycle, the wheel of life, by which, in the fullest state of health, food is carried from the soil to the stomach, and then, as so-called waste, is carried back again to the soil. If we keep faith with this cycle, we humans can continue to eat indefinitely. Otherwise, we cannot. If the waste of farm animals, as of farm-dependent humans, actually is wasted, then we're eating finite quantities that we will finally eat up entirely, at which point we will cease to eat. The fertility cycle is entirely a cycle of living creatures, passing again and again through birth, growth, maturity, death, and decay. Industrial technologies may shortcut the cycle for a while, but such shortcuts also interrupt it, bringing it and us into danger. Now, Aloma did a very brave thing by committing me to say words of wisdom. And I'm going to read a philosophical piece called Down in the Valley Where the Green Grass Grows. The greatest philosophical intensity, I think, is in the first sentence, so listen quick. You would think a fella whose paunch was bigger than his ass would take the precaution of underdrawers or suspenders or bib overalls. Big Ellis didn't, of course. He never thought of precautions until too late. After it was too late, he could always tell you what the right precaution would have been if only he had thought of it. Burley, he would say, I see the point. I've got my sights dead on it. But he saw it going away from behind. And so when he was a young man and had grown to his full girth, his pants, as a rule, were either half on or he was holding them with one hand to keep them from falling off. Big was late getting married. Marriage was a precaution he didn't think of until his mother died and left him alone to cook and housekeep for himself. And then he really began to hear the call of matrimony. I should say this story is set in 1930. He was quite a dancer in his young days. You would think at first it was the funniest thing you ever saw. The fiddle music would carry him clean out of his head, and there he would be, swinging his partner like she didn't weigh anything, with his hair in his eyes, his shirt tail half out, sweating like a horse, his pants creeping down, and that one hand from time to time jerking them back up. But if you paid attention to him, you would soon see that he really was a dancer. He was a smooth mover, a big man, but light on his feet. His feet had ways of going about their business as if he himself didn't know what they were up to. They were answering the music, you see, and not just the caller. He could really step it off. He could cut a shine. He did all right in his socializing until he got his eye set on a girl. And then he would get shy and awkward and tongue-tied. He would figure then that he needed to get her cornered in some clever and mannerly way that would be beyond his abilities. And he would come up with some of the damnedest, longest way around schemes, such as nobody ever thought of before, and were always well worth knowing about. He edged up to a girl one time at the 4th of July and said, "I know a girl's about the prettiest thing ever I looked at," and was struck dumb when she said, "Who?" He wrote one a love letter in his outrageous pencil writing and signed it, "A Friend." He brought one a live big catfish and held it out to her like it was gold-plated and never offered so much as to skin it. Those times, I have to say, he was not very serious. What he had in his mind then was sport, as you might call it. When he began to shine up to Annie Mae Cordell with the honorable intention of marrying her if she would have him, he outdid himself for judgment. She was about as near the right match for him as he could have found. But he went about the business as perfectly hind end foremost as you would have expected. For a while he just hung around her every time he got a chance, looking as big-eyed and solemn as a dying calf. If she looked at him and said anything to him, he turned red and grinned with more teeth than a handsaw and hitched up his pants with both hands. After he got his crop sold that winter, Big did what he usually would do. He took it in his head to trade off the team of mules he already had, maybe adding a few dollars to boot for a better team. He always thought he got a good deal on a better team, and that was why he never in his life owned a team that was better than passable. In fact, he was too big-hearted and generous, especially if he'd had a drink or two, to be any account at all as a trader. Somebody always took his old team and his money, and he wound up with a team just a teensy bit better or worse than what he had before. And so, of course, he was always wanting to trade. By springtime, sure enough, he had his new team, a rabbity pair of three-year-old red mules, not above 15 hands, Dick and Buck. They sort of matched, and he was proud of them, though they were not hardly what you would call well broke. The weather got warm. We needed rain. And then we got a showery day that was about what the doctor ordered and made us feel good. The next day it fared up. The ground being too wet to work and the day fine, I walked over to Biggs to see what I could put him up to. He was a good one to wander about with on such a day. He was a good companion, always ready for whatever you needed him for. I thought we might drop down to the river and fish a while, maybe. But when I got to his place, he was hitching his new team to the sled. He was going to take a bunch of broken tools to the blacksmith shop in town to get them fixed. It was never any trouble at Biggs to find broken tools, which wasn't because he worked all that hard. He just used things hard. Or he used them for purposes they weren't meant for. He treated wood the same as steel. He had piled onto the sled a plow with a broken handle, a hoe with a broken handle, a grubbing hoe with no handle, a broken double tree, and other such, too big a load to take in his old car. "Why don't you use the wagon?" I said. "Oh," he said, "I forgot. Here, hold the lines a minute." He went into the wagon shed and came back rolling a wagon wheel with two broken spokes. So there was nothing for it but the sled, which wasn't the best vehicle on a gravel road and with no tongue, behind a team the least bit touches. And especially that little buck mule, if I had him pegged right, was just waiting for a good reason to demonstrate his speed. He was the reason Big asked me to hold the lines while he went to get the wagon wheel. Big had left himself a place to stand in amongst the load. I made myself a place and turned up a 5-gallon bucket to sit on. Big told the mules to come up and gave the lines a little flip, and we started off with pretty much of a jerk. When we hit the gravel, which we would be on all the way to town, you could see that both mules became deeply concerned. They got into a little jiggling trot and backed their ears so as not to miss anything that might be gaining on them. And the runners did screech and batter something awful. But Big was stout enough to hold them and two more like them if his old lines and bridles held together. Just looking at the back of him, I could see how pleased he was with his team, showing spirit the way they were. And they matched, you know. To some people, and Big was one, a bad team that matches is better than a good team that don't. So we went stepping pretty lively into Port William. I unloaded the sled at the blacksmith shop while Big kept hold of the lines, and then we started back. There was no chance of loafing a while in town, for the mules couldn't be trusted to stand tied. One backfire from somebody's automobile, and they might have disappeared off like two mosquitoes. But when we got to the mouth of our lane, Big drove right on by. I saw then what he had on his mind. His real business for that morning wasn't to take a bunch of broken tools to town. He was going out by the Cordles place. If Annie Mae was there, she could see. If Annie Mae was where she could see, she was going to have the benefit of a look at that well-matched, high-spirited team of mules, and of old Big standing there holding the lines, calm as George Washington, everything under control. The trouble was, by the time we were closing in on the Cordles, after the extra mile or so, the mules had lost their fine edge. They had worn down to a civilized manner of doing business. They were walking along, nodding their heads and letting their ears wag like a seasoned team. Looked like they both together didn't have an ounce of drama left in them, and the large impression Big was wanting to make had fallen by the wayside. So, without making a sudden motion, I got on my knees and skimmed up a rock about the size of a pocket watch and settled back onto my bucket. Big, among other things, was a lucky creature. For when we came in sight of the Cordles house down in the pretty little swale where their farm was, there was Annie Mae, sure enough, looking sweet as a rose, right out on the front porch. She was churning, working the dasher up and down at a steady gait. She looked patient, gazing off at the sky. Maybe the butter was slow to come, and she had been at it a while. I was wanting to help Big all I could, of course. I waited until I was sure Annie Mae had seen us coming, until we could almost hear the dasher chugging in the churn. And then I shied that little rock almost under the buck mule's tail where he felt it the most. He lost no time in taking offense. He clamped his tail down and humped up in the back, which notified the dick mule that the end of the world was at hand. They shot off both at once like their tails were afire. I swear, I had no idea I was going to need a handhold as quick as I did. Just as I was starting backwards off of my bucket, I grabbed a double handful of Big's pants. And down they came. He said very conversationally, "Burley Coulter, damn your impudent hide." But he stood to his work. He had to, of course. He made the drive past the Cordles as magnificent as you please, proudly and calmly in control of his spirited team that was plunging on the bits, with his pants down around his ankles and his shirt tail flying out behind. As we went past, I glanced up at Annie Mae, and so help me Jesus, she was smiling and waving. A good-hearted, patient, forgiving, well-fleshed girl, just right for Big. Well, old Big did keep his team in hand. He never let them go out of a short lope. Pretty soon he stopped them and got his pants back up more or less where they belonged and took the long way home so he wouldn't have to pass the Cordles again. He never looked at me or said a word. He wasn't speaking. But when we finally got back to his place and had put away the mules, which were a good deal better broke by then, I felt obliged to have a serious talk with him. "Big," I said, "you're going to have to ask that woman to marry you after you've done showed yourself to her the way you have." You couldn't beat him for good nature. He just grinned, clean back to his ears. He said, "All right, I reckon I will." So he was speaking to me again. And afterwards, he told me all about it. He was giggling, red in the face, and absolutely tickled almost to death. He gave up all his clever notions about courting and was forthright. When he saw Annie Mae in town next time, he said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." She followed him out of earshot of the other people. And he said, "Well, you done had a look at my private life. Don't you reckon me and you ought to get married?" She looked straight back at him and laughed. She laughed right into his face, like the good old gal she was. She said, "I would like to know why not."
I asked Wendell if he wanted to discuss anything, and he said, if somebody wants to discuss, he'll respond. Any further comments on the day, on Wendell's wisdom, on Big? Anybody have anything they want to say before we adjourn this excellent day? Seeing no hands, thank you again, Wendell Berry. We are adjourned. I will see you next year, God willing.